would like to welcome Dr. Micha Goodman, who is a prominent voice in Israel on issues of Zionism, Judaism, and issues facing contemporary world Jewry. Dr. Goodman, who's the son of Americans who made Aliyah in 1969, received his PhD from Hebrew University in Jewish thought, and he still lectures on Jewish thought there. He's a senior research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute, a teacher at the Tikva Project at Princeton University, and has a popular weekly Israeli TV show on biblical figures. He's written two Israeli bestsellers on canonical Jewish books, the Mor Nevuchim, which is coming out in English next year, I saw, and the Kuzari, and both have won numerous prizes. He's the creator and director of Ein Prat, Academy for Leadership in Israel. And if you're interested in knowing more about this unique learning experience, there's a wonderful article in this week's Jewish Standard on Dr. Goodman, Ein Prat, and its work. And as well, there was an article about a year ago in the Jewish Week by our member Gary Rosenblatt, also speaking about Ein Prat and Dr. Goodman. Of course, if you're among the 3.2 million plus people who clicked on Ein Prat's YouTube hit Dip the Apple in the Honey, which I did this afternoon, you know already that Ein Prat is not a typical Beit Midrash. He has addressed the World Jewish Congress on a new paradigm for Zionism, which is half of his lecture topic tonight, the collapse of Israel's secular religious divide and the emergence of a new Zionist paradigm. It's our pleasure to welcome Dr. Goodman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What I hope to achieve tonight is to try to convince you that Israel is changing and there is a great opportunity. There is exciting things happening in Israel. And I'll present some thoughts and please ask me whatever you want. And the conversation about Israel could always be loaded, always be interesting, and I'm open to any direction this will take us. Okay, I'd like to start to think about Israel with the dominant group that created Israel, and it's still to some extent the most powerful group creating the ethos of Israel. It's a group that sociologists from Hebrew U, Baruch Kimmerling, calls the Ahusalim. The Ahusalim. It's an attempt to create a, how do you say, Rashi Tevot?
An acronym
that would be parallel to the WAS. Israelis have the WAS. Now, how does he understand this? What is the Israeli WAS? It's the Stam Israeli, the person that's just an Israeli. Like his argument is, I learned about a WASP in one of his books, he says that it used to be that in America, you had no jokes about WASPs. Because a joke about a WASP was a joke about an American goes on to an airplane, that American is a WASP. Because if it wasn't a WASP, if it was an Italian-American, an African-American, an American-Jew, you'd say that. But a stop. So his argument, in Israel, there's just an Israeli. And who's the group that has a monopoly over representation of the Israelis? It's the Ahusal. What is Ahusal? Aleph is for Ashkenazi, or Europei, or European. Chet is for what? Chiloni. The founding group of the Israeli ethos, secular Israelis. Vav is for Vatik, meaning old timers. They didn't just get off the boat. And here it gets tricky, it's not true anymore. Kimmel, he writes this in the 70s. Samich is for Socialist. All capitalists today. And the Lamed is for Leumi. Nationalists. They're less nationalists today, but we know what we're talking about. It's the groups that founded the kibbutzim in the turn of the century. And they're the ones who founded Tel Aviv. And they're the ones who founded the mainstream political power that created Israel. It was the Ben-Gurions, it was the kibbutzim, it was Mapaz. They're the Ahusalim. Now, in order to understand Israel, it's a good idea to think about the history of this group. I'm not a historian. I want to think about the philosophy of this group. What are the major ideas that dominated this group? So to think about what happened to this group, the rise and fall of the ideas of this group, we have to think of two great thinkers. One is Micha Yosef Berdichevsky, one of the greatest philosophers that created the major ideas that this group was inspired from when they created Israel. And another thinker is Echad HaAm, Asher Ginzburg, Echad HaAm. Another important thinker, but I want to learn now is the disagreement between these two great thinkers. I'd like to start with Berdichevsky, and to think about, so Berdichevsky writes a lot about what Zionism is about and what it should be about. Now when we listen to Berdichevsky, and to his great disciple Brenner, and to other important Israelis that were highly influenced by these two, like Ben-Gurion, and Nachman Sirkin from a different direction, they say unbelievable things about Jews. Brenner says, Hayid Mechoar. The Jew is ugly. And another place he says, I efshar shelo lisno et ha-Yehudi. It's impossible not to despise the Jew. Nice thing. By the way, Herzl writes somewhere else. In his personal diary, I went to an event today. I had a great time. There was only one problem with that event. Too many Jews. Jabotinsky has similar writings. An important public intellectual in Israel, Adam Rubinstein, listened to all these statements. And what he realized, that when you listen to the writings of the founding fathers of Israel, and the way they spoke about Jews, well, you could say it. How does this all sound like? Sounds like anti-Semitism. So, and I don't know how you guys teach or you learn Zionism here in North America. By the way, I'm not an American. I wasn't born in America. I wasn't raised in America. I'm an Israeli, born and raised, never outside of Israel for more than a month. But I'm practicing for the past 6 years. I'm trying to fake a perfect American accent. How am I doing so far?
Pretty good.
Thanks. But just American. It's not like Bostonian, though, right? It's not, I'm just Stam. I'm a Stam in America.
A wasp.
Yeah. I can't. Now, is there a New Jersey have an accent?
Yeah, some parts, yeah, but it's vulgar. You don't want
to. Now, maybe one day I'll try to do that. So, where was I? What? Oh, okay. So I don't know how they learn Zionism here in America. But here in Israel, this is how they teach Zionism. There was anti-Semitism, and Zionism was our reaction to anti-Semitism. Right? The classic narrative, Herzl, the way he started to deal with the problem of the Jews was emancipation, and then he went to Dreyfus, and he saw people yelling outside of the courts in Paris, death to the Jews, and he realized anti-Semitism is here, and it's here to stay, and now we should have, and he moved from emancipation to Zionism. That's the classic narrative of Zionism. It's a reaction to anti-Semitism. Maybe it's not. Amon Rubinstein offers a different thought. Maybe it's not only a reaction to anti-Semitism, maybe it's also an internalization of the anti-Semitic worldview. There was something with an anti-Semitic flavor in the writings, in the Bible language of the founding fathers of Israelism. But there is a difference. The difference is that anti-Semitism, just like Zionism, sees Judaism as a disease. This is the worst version. But anti-Semites see it as a genetic disease. Zionists thought as an environmental disease. Meaning, we could cure it. You take Jews out of this climate, put them in Israel, in warm Israel, give them a gun, work the ground, and a new Jew will be born. A new Jew. As Jabotinsky put it with an amazing line, will create a, hold on tight, Geza Psychologi Chadash Shel Yehudim, a new psychological breed of Jews. Micha Yosef Berdyshevsky puts it this way, Anachnu, says Micha Yosef Berdyshevsky, we, Anachnu Dor Acharon Shel Yehudim. Unbelievable. We are the last generation of Jews. This is it. V'dor Rishon Le'ivrim. And the first generation of Hebrews. Meaning, Zionism is not only a political movement, it's also a therapeutic movement. It's an attempt to cure the Jew. And in order to try to understand this part of Zionism, it's a less spoken part of Zionism, not the political aspect, but the therapeutic aspect, that the real ambition of Zionism wasn't only political, meaning to create a state that didn't exist. It was also an attempt to create a Jew that didn't exist. That was the real ambition of Zionism, of the founding fathers of Israelism. They wanted to listen to what they tried to achieve. And so to listen to what they tried to achieve, I want to listen to their critique about the disease of the Judaism. What's the critique? This is what people like to call an anthropological critique of religion. When I say anthropological critique of religion, as opposed to theological critique of religion, I'll try to explain this point. Theological critique of religion is when people like Feuerbach and Freud and other people, they criticize the idea of religion, saying that the revelation couldn't happen. Torah wasn't given in Sinai. There is no archaeological evidence. It's like trying to criticize the notion that God is the source of religion. I mean, the fundamentals of faith. Anthropological critique is different. It's not to criticize what you believe in. The origin. Origins. I told you in Israel. The roots. You don't criticize the roots, questioning if it's defined, the roots of religion. You criticize the product. The product. It's not saying God is not the source, it's saying the type of human being that's a product of Judaism is the kind of person you don't want to be. It's an allergic reaction to the person as the product. That would be anthropological critique of religion. Now, the founding fathers of Zionism, their critique was anthropological. And they thought that the product of halacha is something gross. Why? To understand this, I'd like to try to understand how, let's try to imagine who is the person that people in the collective imagination of these founding fathers of Israelism, who are the people in the Galut in the diaspora admire? Who do you admire? First of all, the normative Jew is a person who obeys halacha. You obey halacha all day, every day. And they were very in tune to a critique of Spinoza on the type of a person that obeys halacha. According to Spinoza, why do you have to obey halacha? Why, according to our legal system, Jews are supposed to obey halacha? Because when you obey halacha all day, every day, that has a tremendous effect on your personality. You're very used to obeying, submitting yourself from authority that's bigger than you. And what does that turn you into in the end? What do you say? A slave. Yeah.
Submissive.
A robot. Not connected to your own will. Spinoza said that this is the manipulation of halacha. That's how it's very easy that Moses created this, argues Spinoza in a moment of heresy. Spinoza had more than one moment, by the way. He created this in order, well, I'm going to share this one, in order to turn Jews into people that are easier to control. So use halacha to turn these people into controllable people. This created disgust in the eyes of the founding fathers of Israelism. Because in here, this is something now, maybe we can understand that the founding fathers, especially about Berdyshevsky. Zionism is here to liberate the Jew. To liberate him from any authority. Now we say any authority, that includes the Goyim. But not only the Goyim. The Jew is also not, he's not only controlled by the goy, he's also controlled by halacha, by God. Or the way Bielichevsky puts it, by his past. And because there's two authorities controlling the Jew, there's also two fears dominating the personality of the Jew. What's the double fear? You're terrified of the goy. You know a TV show, if I was Israeli, but really it's American, called Friends? Mm-hmm. You have this in America? If I was Israeli, you sure? You know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So there's this guy, Chandler. And I think I have a great insight of how people are pathetic next to their bosses. Pathetic next to their bosses. Because when you're afraid of someone, you're pathetic. And you overlap from the joke of the boss. That's how pathetic people behave next to power. You overlap. And they picked up on this. And Chandler, he has a work laugh. You ever see that chapter? He has a work laugh, meaning the laugh he only expresses next to his boss. And once his girlfriend, Monica, comes with him to work, and she's embarrassed that she asks him, "What is that?" And he says, "Oh, that's my work laugh." Now, this is a moment when you realize, I think, if you want to listen carefully to the disgust the founding fathers have of Judaism, of the Galut, it's the fact that they were pleasing the goy, that they were trying to satisfy the goy, the fact that they were reacting to power with fear, and fear was something they wanted to take out of the Jewish personality. But it's not only fear of the goy. There's a second fear. The fear of what?
God.
Of God. Now listen, religion is very good at injecting fear in the hearts and minds of people that follow religions. Because how does religion inject fear in the hearts and minds of people? Using what? Stories of that way? Yeah, hell. Gehenna. Yeah. I mean, if you don't obey halacha, what will happen to you? Well, here we could use the afterlife and speak about hell. And that's pretty scary. There is a Israeli preacher that manages to convince many people to obey halacha with these stories about hell. I once heard a lecture, because it was actually very entertaining. He says, "Atem yodim lama lo kedai lachem alechet lagehenom? Do you know why? You shouldn't go to hell. It's not a good idea to find yourself in hell." And the entire audience says, 10,000 people in a basketball stadium say, "Why?" You can find this on YouTube. And he says, "Ki cham sham." Because it's warm there.
Hot.
What? It's hot. It's too hot. Don't go there. It's too hot. Now you ask yourself, this is very serious. This is very serious. Two authorities create two sets of fears. The fear of the goy that creates pathetic behavior, and the fear of God that creates halacha, neurotic, halachic observance. You're afraid of what the goy will do to you during your lifetime, and what God will do to you after your lifetime. So living with two authorities is living with two sets of fears, and Zionism is here to liberate you from your fear by liberating you the double fear through liberating you from the double authority. That's why Zionism comes in the same package with secularism. Because Zionism is to liberate you from the control of the goy, and secularism is to liberate you from control of the past. And together, in this package, you're a liberated Jew. Shake off all authority, shake off the fear, and create this new Jew, this uncontrollable Jew, the Jew with no fear, the Jew with no authority, the Jew that can't be controlled, this new Nietzschean Jew, the Jew that goes to the army and works the land, and he doesn't care about what anyone says, not God, not the goy. Ben Gurion captures this in a great line. He says, "Lo chashuv mahagoyim yagidu, chashuv mahayehudim yasu." It doesn't matter what the goyim will say, it only matters what the Jews will do. We don't care about the goy. We don't care. Sirkin says, we don't care about halacha. Sirkin says Zionism is an attack on religion. We don't care about halacha. Nothing can control us. There's no boundaries on our behavior. Nothing, no social norms can control us. By the way, that includes manners too. I'm serious. What are manners? It's artificial norms that, you know, that impose boundaries on our behavior. Why? Why? Zionism is an attempt to escape any attempt to be controlled, to create a new liberated Jew. And some say Zionism was too successful. But it was very, very successful. By the way, I just want to notice, the only person here wearing a tie today is the Israeli. I'm the only one. But this is a good moment. My wife won, because I remember about 13 years ago, one of the things you don't understand when North Americans meet Israelis is that there's not only a clash of language, it's a clash of body language. It's a clash of body language. Because you see, when an Israeli puts on a suit and a tie, you know how Israelis interpret that? Like, who does he think he is? He's honoring himself. And when an American puts on a suit and a tie, why is he doing that?
To honor someone else.
Because he's noticing someone else. So when an American walks in with a suit and a tie to a world filled with Israelis, he's thinking, wow, I'm respecting them. And they're thinking, he's respecting himself. It's a clash of languages.
Culture.
It's a culture, because Israelis are a very successful product of the Zionist revolution. Where the most holy word in Hebrew is dukri, is being staying straight. It's not even in Hebrew, by the way. It's in Arabic. Okay, sticking dukri, saying it straight, saying it as it is. Israelis interpret, when they see American behavior, they interpret what you would see as being polite, Israelis see as being savua.
Arrogant.
No, not arrogant.
Hypocritical. They're full smiling.
And is there,
when you see going to the store, everybody's smiling and say, well, he doesn't know me, why don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And Americans, what Americans see when Israelis speak as being rude, Israelis see as being offended. And by the way, there's a lot to this, because Israelis are a very successful product of a Zionist revolution trying to shake off any attempts to quit. Now, I come the way I am. No social, no limitations, no social norms. I know that when I speak in North America, I never really know how I did, by the way. Because no matter what happens, well, Goodman, thank you very much, it was marvelous. And in Israel, you always get, like, painful honesty. Goodman, chava. But this is that's why, by the way, it's very hard. Zionism is a tremendous, tremendous revolution in political, psychological, and body language. And this is a revolution that not every Israeli was a part of. This is the revolution created by the Ahusalim, and they created the ethos of Israelism. And they in some way, for many generations, they owned the monopoly of what does it mean to be an Israeli. So I want to summarize very quickly the point I made till now. If Galuth, if the opposite of Zionism is having controlled by two authorities that create two different sets of fears, Zionism as a liberation movement trying to liberate the Jew from both authorities, from the Gentiles and from the past. And the greatest articulator of this is Berdichevsky, and they created secular, liberated, straightforward, somewhat angry Israeli. Angry of the past. Angry towards religion. Angry towards anyone without trying to... And by the way, in order to... I think part of the irrational relationship between Israelis and Haredim, the Ahusalim and the Haredim, comes from here. Because when an Israeli sees a Haredi, what does he see in the Haredi? In the Haredi? We see the Jew we tried not to be. And an allergic reaction comes out, which has that flavor of the original, what I call pseudo-antisemitism that we had from the very beginning. It reminds us of what we wanted to be. This has a lot to do with the psycho-historical interpretation of the famous meeting between Ben-Gurion and the Chazon Ish. Ben-Gurion, the leader of the Ahusalim, and the Chazon Ish, the leader of the Haredim. And Chazon Ish asked Ben Gurion to let 400 yeshiva boys exempt them from the army. Uh-huh. And a classic analysis is the following analysis. Ben Gurion thought it was a good idea. There was a sense, like many people thought throughout the world until the 60s, that religion is part of our past. Secularization was a process going through history. In the future, we'll all be secular. In the past, we'll be religious. And he thought that creating like a museum that's holding on to the old Jew you wanted to be, is a good idea to energize secularism and the energy of the new Israeli identity. Because when there's a museum, every time we'll go back to the museum and we'll see the old Jew, will we notice how new we are, how fresh we are? The problem is that the museum grew. And it grew. And I go, some Israelis are afraid today that they'll put them in a museum. I want to go back to Berlichevsky, to these very powerful intuitions, Zionism as a double liberation. Zionism not only is a political movement, but also a therapeutic movement, because that wasn't the only option that Zionism offered. There was also another option, Chada'am. Now what did Chada'am understand? He also wanted to liberate the Jew. It was about liberation. And not only from the goy, also from tradition. Not to be controlled. But what Chada'am understood when he tried to advocate that in order to be liberated from tradition, it doesn't mean I have to disconnect myself from tradition. I don't have to be angry at tradition. I don't have to rebel against tradition. I don't have to attack tradition in order to be liberated from tradition. On the contrary, I could still learn Bible. I could still master the Talmud. I don't have to be controlled by it. I could be inspired by it. What difference between these texts as sources of authority? That's how Orthodox people will see these texts. Or see them as sources of inspiration. That's how Chada'am would see these texts. And what's the obvious fundamental difference between authority and inspiration? If it's authority, so the text controls me. If it's inspiration, I'm still in control. It's more than the respect. Here's a contemporary Israeli Echad HaAmist, Amos Oz. I think you call it Amos Oz.
Amos Oz, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So this is how he says it. If Jewish tradition is a Yerusha, an inheritance, so you inherit all the furniture of your grandfather. That's a nice thing. But you decide what you're going to put in the dining room, what you're going to put in the living room, what you're going to put in the front of the house, and what you're going to hide in the basement. You decide. I would say orthodoxy is about everything you inherit, what do you do with it? You put it all in the living room. And Berlichevsky secularism is everything you inherit, what do?
Put it in the basement.
You give it away. Yeah. Let someone else deal with it. Yeah. And Amos Oz expressing the Chada'am Judaism, if it's inspiration, who doesn't control me, but it empowers me, and I'm still, here's the difference, instead of being liberated from tradition, Berlichevsky, I could liberate tradition. That's a Chada'am. He had a vision. You know, this is how I've learned to understand the disagreement of the Chada'am and Berlichevsky, because I think if we can understand this disagreement, we have a key to understand Israel, the culture in Israel today, and the clashes in the culture of Israel today. Just like if you understand this again between Hillel and Shammai that opens the Talmudic world to you, we can understand the conflict between Berlichevsky and the Chada'am, we can understand mainstream Israelis. And this is how I learned to understand the disagreement between Berlichevsky and the Chada'am. Berlichevsky argues that it's impossible to take tradition stripped from authority. Tradition has to come with authority, and that's why the only way to get rid of authority is to get rid of all the tradition together. This is how I've learned to, I'm sure we all have a person in our lives that used to carry a lot of authority and we're terrified from him. And then once you grow older, that person doesn't have his authority anymore. And how do you build a new relationship with the person without his authority? Are you with me? When I was in the army in basic training, I had a commander called Humphukidnia. For some reason, when I say his name, I have to go into a little voice. Humphukidnia.
The commander Egad.
And Ram was in basic training, so he was not, it wasn't fun. He would make us run and run and run. And I was the kind of soldier that always lost everything. Now, when I was in basic training, the sanction for losing something is you're now attached to it. It's hard to explain. Let's say I lose this, so I have to carry this with me, like for a week. So those are the kind of sanctions. So I remember one. These painful memories, I'm using you for therapy. So, I remember I lost this big jerry can of slim. I don't know how you say this.
A jerry can
of 20 liters. You know what I mean? It's a big container of water. I lost it. So I was supposed to carry, wherever I go, this big jerry can. And then obviously, I lost it again. So he says to me, Gutman, and looks at his watch, Balayla ani v'ata. At nighttime, it's just me against you. So I'm waiting for him, nighttime, terrified. And he says to me, you see that tree at the top of the hill? I have to carry this, jerry can to the top of the hill, come back. I was climbing this hill. Then I realized I'm all alone. He's not here. He can't see me. I decide, well, I'll fake it. I turn around to run down. And who did I see? Him. He was there to catch me. I was a month in the army. These are terrible memories. Why am I sharing this with you? First of all, because you're cheap. Yeah. But second, because many years later, well, throughout the army, I became an officer, I became the head of a brigade. I go to university, I get my first degree, second degree, PhD. Yeah, like you said, I teach in university, and then one day, who do I see walking down the corridor of Hebrew U? I'm fucking the guy. So I see him. Now, this is now the hierarchy. He's just a sergeant, and I'm a command, and I outrank him. He's in his first year in university, wasted his life, he just came to university. I am the university. And I see him, and the moment I see him, the first thing, shalom forget. I'm terrified. I see him, I can only see his authority. And he's like, oh. So I ask myself, after my interaction with him, can I somehow change my vision so I can't see him as the big commander he was and just see Eyal? Next time I look at him, I'll just see Eyal. A few days later, I see him from far. I have anxiety. I'm like all excited. I'm going to see my big commander. And I realize, oh my God, Micha, I just look. I went to another corridor. See, this is Belichevsky would argue that tradition, that authority is so intimately attached to tradition, that every time we see a Talmud, we see a Bible, what happens to us? It carries authority. We can't strip tradition from its authority. It can't be just a source of inspiration. It can't be something that enriches us, empowers us. It will always control us. Pastor Delichevsky says, the only way to deal with this, to liberate the Jew, is to get rid of the entire tradition altogether. Echad Ha'am said, as opposed to my relationship with Amfakir Dayan, Echad Ha'am says, it's possible to mature. It's possible to grow up. It's possible to be liberated from tradition and then to liberate tradition. It's possible. Now this disagreement between Belichevsky and Echad Ha'am is a disagreement that I think it's fair to say, it's a disagreement that what does it mean to be secular Israeli? It's fair to say that throughout the generations, who won the argument, who created the paradigm for secular Israelism? Belichevsky. Secular Israelism, for many reasons, was angry secularism that turned into ignorant secularism. Then a secularism that rejects everything that's Jewish, that's angry at tradition. That's an allergic reaction to people that look like tradition. And we paid a terrible price. One of the prices that we paid is that if the dominant paradigm for Israelism is you're disconnected from your past, so almost by definition, you're disconnected from the rest of the Jews in the world that share that past. You see, what do we have in connect? What's in connection between a Jew in Rishon, a Jew in Jerusalem, and a Jew in New Jersey? What connects them? We don't have the same space What we have is the same time. What we have is a shared past. But if I'm not connected to that past, so I'm not connected to people who share that past. This is one of the saddest paradoxes of Zionism. The Jewish state was created because of great solidarity shared by Jews, because Jews care about Jews. And that solidarity created the energy that created the Jewish state, and now that Jewish state is blocking within its boundaries that solidarity. So this is one of the prices that we're paying because of the victory of Gordievsky secularism. What I want?
Can I just ask one question? How does that manifest itself?
Again?
When you say that they're blocking their past and they're not connected to their past, they're not, you know, the Jews of Montevideo, how does that manifest itself? In what way?
In what way? That in 2006, when there was the war in Lebanon, and so I had the privilege to be posted in the Golan Heights. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun because you know how people sent packages to the soldiers? And the packages couldn't enter Lebanon because it was a war zone? So you know where all the packages came to? The Golan Heights. So you know what I did the entire war? I had a hard war. It was hard. It was tough. I was opening packages. No, because what happened was we were there just in case. We were in the Golan Heights because people fought for good reasons, and it's possible that who will join the war? The Syrians. So you were just waiting for the Syrians. Now you know the end of the war. The Syrians didn't come. We didn't know that then. But all the packages that couldn't go into Lebanon came to me and my soldiers. It was a nice thing. So we're opening packages. And I remember one moment, you know, packages from all over Israel. And I remember one moment, we get a package from Vermont. And suddenly I realized there's packages from L.A., packages, I guess, from Israel. You think there's packages all over the Jewish world. Did you guys send us packages, by the way?
Yeah.
Thanks. That was good, thanks. Next time, chocolate chip cookies. So they all came. Now, to the soldiers that leave at least. Now, and I remember my soldiers asking me, why are we getting packages from Vermont? It was a specific package in Vermont. And I realized that they don't get it. So I have this metaphor. That you see, you don't understand. You're imagining that there's a war now. We're in this war. Our friends are in Lebanon. We might be in Syria soon. There's this war now. And all these packages are like a vote of confidence, like motivation. All the Israelis on the bleachers?
Bleachers.
All the bleachers rallying for us. But what you don't understand, it's not the Israelis rallying for us. It's all the Jews are rallying for us. Now I realize, when they close their eyes, they think about their circle of solidarity is the world of the Israelis. But for that one moment, with that package from Vermont, at one moment, they realized that the circle of solidarity is larger than the state of Israel. It's the entire Jewish world. For that moment, they were Jewish. But you see, when your past is 65 years old, so your solidarity is also the size of the state of Israel. But if your past is 3,000 years old, that's relevant to you. So your solidarity breaks the boundaries of the state of Israel. Did I answer you?
Mm-hmm.
The price for Gordievsky for disconnecting yourself from the past meant a strong disconnection to American Jews. I want to share with you something. It's sad. I shouldn't share this with you. I shouldn't, going back and forth, I see how so many Americans are so curious about Israel. I wish today if you have in you, I see, you know, the Israel Day Parade, amazing, I couldn't understand, amazing. And American Jews are so curious about Israel, they read books about Israel, and articles about Israel, and give money to Israel, and are interested in Israel, and are angry at Israel, and are involved in Israel, and emotionally involved. You know what Israelis think about American Jews?
They don't.
It's an asymmetric curiosity. I told my students, they thought, don't worry, it's becoming symmetric. It's not becoming symmetric because Israelis are interested in American Jews. It's becoming symmetric because American Jews are becoming less interested in Israel. So finally, the good news is we're going to have finally a balanced relationship. It's nice. Okay, I didn't come here to tell you that stuff. I actually think something exciting is happening in Israel. But before that, I wanted to understand the disagreement and one of its implications on this relationship. But in the past 15 years, something big is happening in Israel and it's beneath the radars. And we find this something that's happening in Israel beneath the radars. We find it, for example, I like to find this in new Israeli music. Kobi Oz. Have you heard any of you hear Kobi Oz? Eti Ankri. Ehud Banai. Ehud. Evyatar Banai. Deri Sakharov. Okay, you know who are these people?
Some of them.
Yeah. Ah, Israeli? Ah, somebody. Ma? Mino Pepa. Okay, okay. But, so here it is. Okay. Now, so. Baruch is like Baruch. Why is it Baruch? Because all these rock stars I've mentioned, they're not the weird avant-garde, doing weird stuff, interesting, challenging the mainstream. That's not them. These are rock stars. They are mainstream, right? Mainstream. Every one of these singers is doing Jewish music today. New tunes to Tehillim, to Yehuda Halevi, to Ibn Gavirol. You see, usually if you come to Israel and you want to listen to Jewish music, so you have to, on the radio, go to the Haredi stations and all the Yababam. Today, if you want to listen to Jewish music, you have to go to Gal Galatz. Gal Galatz is, when you come to Israel, it's 91.8. And this is mainstream.
Like 95.5.
It's like 95.5. Yeah. Now you ask yourself, what happened here? What happened here? I had a great conversation with Kobi Oz about this. And he says to me, well, he says to me a number of things, but the main thing he says to me is, you have to understand, Micha, music in Israel is a free market. And we want young people to come to concerts. That's how we're Jewish. The artists are the first to notice a new zeitgeist. That something changed. Now, what's happening? What's happening that the Israeli movie that was a nominee for an Oscar was about Talmudic scholars. Now, when I saw that one morning, footnote, when I saw that one morning, reading the newspaper, I thought it might be an illusion, because I know that there's about four people in the Talmud department in Hebrew U. Maybe three. Yeah, they're all there. And suddenly, this is what interests people. To write movies about, TV shows about. You generously mentioned my books, becoming bestsellers. This couldn't have happened 10 years ago. A book about the guy with the plagues becoming a bestseller in Israel, this couldn't have happened. Books are becoming, about Judaism, are becoming popular. Something is happening. And Ayn Pratt, in 2006, we had seven kids. After the army, coming to learn Judaism or philosophy, seven kids. Why would they come? And we're weird. Why would they come? And then after 4 months, we had eight. We did a party. Eight. And then it grew to 17. And then to 45. I'll fast forward. This year, we have 315 students. After the army, paying money to come and learn this stuff, almost all of them secular. What's happening? And we have a wave of new curiosity, of hunger in Israel. A new hunger. A new thirst. We see that in your music. We have a new... Now, what's happening? I tell you what's not happening. What's not happening, it's not secular Israelis becoming religious. That's not happening. Larry, think about it. It's not Chiloni becoming Dati. It's not secular becoming religious. It's Israelis becoming Jewish. Meaning the dominant part of our identity is becoming more Jewish and less Israeli. Or a different way to think about it, it's not secular becoming religious, it's one kind of a secular Israeli becoming a different kind of a secular Israeli. Echad Ha'am came back. It's a movement from Beluchevsky type secularism to Echad Ha'am type secularism. It's still liberated, still not controlled by the past, but now we want to be inspired by the past. We want to know the past. We want to see the past. We want to use, we want, back to Amos Oz's metaphor, we want our inheritance. We'll choose what we keep. But someone deprived us from it. This is a very important move happening in Israel, still not mainstream. It's still not big, but it's growing. It's growing. This phenomenon has momentum in Israel today. And this phenomenon, let's think about the implications. One of the implications that is, if the Ahusalim, if mainstream Israelis are now connected to their past, so I think they're going to start feeling connected to all the people that share that past. This is something happening in Israel. It's not the only thing happening, but this is a very serious, unspoken phenomenon happening in Israel. And I flew all the way to New Jersey to tell you about this. I had some other stuff also, but this was something that we need to, that's important to learn about and to think about and to know about. It has a lot of implications. So I'd like to finish this presentation, open it to your questions, with the following thoughts. What does this mean about orthodoxy in Israel? What do you mean about orthodoxy in Israel? We have a new wave of secular Israelis that are starving for Judaism. And they don't see Judaism as an authority. They overcame my mefaked yad metaphor. By the way, you know why they overcame it? What?
They grew up.
They grew up. When I was 16, my father caught me in the basement of my parents' house reading Encyclopedia Britannica. It was a shocking moment. He sees his son reading. I'm sure he thought, Micha doesn't have any friends. I had this thing, maybe I'll read the entire encyclopedia and I'll be smart. I had this like teenage thing. And he was like looking at me, and we were both, and he says to me, Micha, that's a great thing. You should continue reading Encyclopedia Britannica. You know what I did? I stopped reading. Why couldn't I read this encyclopedia? Why couldn't I read this? Well, first of all, that's what. But because if I'm 16, if my father wants me to read this, so what just happened to that experience? It's not mine anymore. It's not mine. It's not my own thing. It's not mine. Now, what would happen today if my father, I don't read, I don't do that. I have some friends. Let's say, he'd see I read it, it's like whatever. Yeah, and he'd say, Micha, I'm very proud of you. I guess if I manage to mature and I'm an adult now, I'm going through a crisis. I'm 40 in 2 months, so I'm going through
midlife crisis.
Yes. Yeah. And he'd say that, I guess what my reaction would be, if I'm healthy, what would it be? Thanks, Dad. I'll continue reading. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference? I grew up. The fact that he improves what I do doesn't mean he controls what I do. Berdichevsky secularism. Let me be judgmental for a minute. Is the only prophet? It's probably kind of the only possible secularism possible for that age. They were trying to liberate themselves from tradition. They were teenagers. They had to know that they're their own. That they're their own. That they own themselves. That they're sovereign. They had to rebel against tradition. This is what people don't understand. And it's important to understand that the return of secular Israelis to tradition is not because they're not secular. It's because they're very secular. It's because they feel so confident in their secular identity, they don't feel that tradition threatens them anymore. It's because of confidence. And I want to think about orthodoxy just for 1 minute. Orthodoxy is also if let's call Berdichevsky secularism secular orthodoxy, in the sense that you are closing yourself to your past. Let's speak about orthodoxy. It also comes from fear. Something else interrupting.
changing me, influencing me. And how do you react to that? This is now the Western world, modernity. How do you react to that? By closing down. In a deep sense, ultra-orthodoxy and secular orthodoxy are reflections of each other. They both want to guard themselves by closing down. Orthodoxy by closing down to the world, and secular orthodoxy by closing down to the past. You know when orthodoxy will be able to open up to the world again? When it won't be so terrified. And you know where orthodoxy doesn't need to be terrified? It's my last insight. Where it doesn't need to be terrified, where it doesn't have to have anxiety that we might be, that there might be few reports, there might be assimilation. You know where we're not scared of assimilation? In Israel. Why are we not afraid of assimilation in Israel? Because there is no assimilation in Israel. Let me finish with the following observation. Israel was created to guard Jews. I don't know if it succeeded. What Ben Gurion called the safe refuge, I don't know. It's possible. One can make an argument that the Constitution of the United States of America guards Jews better than the IDF if Iran has a bomb. It's possible. I don't know. It's possible. One can make that argument. I see you don't like it. One could make that argument. I don't make that argument. Okay. But I think the main thing that Israel guards today is not the Jews, it's Judaism. Because Judaism is guarded, it's protected in Israel. There's no assimilation in Israel. There is none.
Who do you assimilate to?
Exactly. You see, this is how Chief Rabbi Jonathan Zaks put it. In America, you are the choosing people. In Israel, we're the chosen people. You know why? Because our identity is chosen for us. We can't choose it. It's chosen for us. Here, if you don't choose it, if you don't invest money in it, energy in it, come outside on a Sunday night to some lecture, if you don't invest energy and money in it, what happens to that identity? It has, Carrie said, fuck.
It disappears.
It doesn't exist. In Israel, without investing any energy, we have a clear Jewish identity. The Jewish identity that's guarded, that can't change in Israel, comes for free. And there's four elements that together create the Jewish Israeli identity. One, you're almost always interacting only with Jews. Interacting with Jews. Two, you're speaking Hebrew. Can you imagine you're speaking Hebrew? Three, you're in Jewish space. Four, you're experiencing Jewish time. In Israel, when people say that before the holidays, they never mean Christmas. It's always Rosh Hashanah. I sat just a week ago with an American. 2 weeks ago, an American friend in a coffee place called Grand Café. You know where that is?
Yeah. It's
across the street. So can you imagine what a Jewish moment this is? He's like very thrilled, saying to me, Israelis all secular. And I'm thinking about, what an amazing moment. We're sitting in Derech Bethlehem. What's more biblical than that? We're on the road to Bethlehem. We're in Jerusalem. I'm ordering coffee from the waitress, and she's a Jew, and we're speaking in Hebrew, and we're Derech Bethlehem, and we all knew it was Lag BaOmer. It was Lag BaOmer. But why is she completely secular? How does she know it's Lag BaOmer? In America, what Jews know it's Lag BaOmer? You have to be very firm. And that's what everybody knows Lag BaOmer, because the calendar is Jewish, because we live in Jewish time, and we live in Jewish space, and we speak the Jewish language, and we interact with Jews. Those four elements, they have to pay a lot of money to get a part of that. I just learned you pay $20,000 for day school.
Kindergarten.
Yeah, it's in Israel. And in Israel, not doing anything, not moving. You could be secular, you could be anti-religious. You could be Nachman Sirkin, anti-religious. And you still live in Jewish time, Jewish space, speaking Jewish language to Jews and almost Jews only. That is a safe haven. That guards Jewish identity. And because it's guarded, assimilation is not an option. That's why I can understand why orthodoxy here in America has a lot of anxiety, and anxiety is a slippery slope. You know, they'll open up, they'll go to college, they'll fall in love, they'll marry up. I know. That's a very serious anxiety. And the anxiety leads to closing down. In Israel, we don't have that anxiety. And that's why in Israel, orthodoxy could open up. What I'm trying to say, and I'll end now, today in Israel, this is not happening yet, but it could happen. The Dati community could open up, because that's the gift that Zionism gave us. It guards us from assimilation. So we don't have to use the defense mechanism that you need to use here in order to fight assimilation. We could open up. We could really open up. We could do that probably only in Israel. And at the same time, secularism might be starting to open up from the threat's past. A confident secular movement in Israel is a secularism that's inspired from the past, and a confident orthodoxy is an orthodoxy that's open to the world. And these are two great gifts of Zionism to Judaism, and it's possible that these gifts will actually happen. It's very possible. So these are some, I hope, exciting observations I wanted to share with you about things that are happening as we're talking in Israel. Finally, 2 days from now is Shavuot. Shavuot is a great example. It used to be that Shavuot for secular Israelis was a day that they celebrated the new Israeli. And the new Israeli was about agriculture. Mm-hmm. So in the kibbutzim, what did they used to celebrate?
Harvest.
Yeah. Bikurim, harvest. Now, throughout Tel Aviv, throughout Israel, not only the team, but tremendous amount of secular Israelis are doing tikkun leil Shavuot. Jerusalem is a place today that, just like in the ancient days, people come to Jerusalem to learn Torah, driving their cars, coming to learn Torah. They're not coming to Beit HaMikdash. They're coming to Beit HaMikdash. They're not coming to offer sin offerings and offer. They're coming to learn. This is happening. This is, and all over Israel, today in the newspapers, it's different tikkunei leil Shavuot, different opportunities to learn Torah by Dati'im and Chayim together. Israel is changing. Israel is changing. And this is a change it's worth studying and connecting to. Because I know that many times when Israelis come to you, they share the crisis of Israel. How Israel is in trouble. Israel is in, if there's a crisis, please help us save Israel. Please help us save us from ourselves. I think Israel is not facing a crisis, it's facing an opportunity. But there's and there's actually, between crisis and opportunity, there's not a very big difference in the sense that both of them call for change. If there's a crisis presents itself and you don't change, what happens to you? You'll collapse. And if an opportunity presents itself, you don't change the way you think and behave, you'll miss the opportunity. There's a big opportunity facing Israel. There's a big opportunity. We might miss it. We might not. But this is a great moment. Okay, let's. Well, I'll just take. How do I do this? One by one or everyone? One by one. Please.
The students have come to you.
Yes.
How do they. They must perceive that they are missing something.
Yeah.
How do they describe that? What do they observe that they feel that is missing from their lives that they come?
Well, great. In Pratt, about 30% Orthodox Israelis, 70% secular Israelis. And if here's a classic line I'll get from a graduate in Pratt if he's Orthodox. He'll say, I came to Ein Pratt and I've opened up. If he's a secular, he probably won't use the metaphor of opening it up. He'll say, I came to Ein Pratt, v'itchabalti. I got connected. I think what Orthodox carry and their problem is being closed, and what secular Israelis feel is disconnected, and both have to go through something different. I think together they're creating a new Israeli mainstream. Okay. Maybe you'll introduce yourself?
Ron Zalazo.
Hi.
I'm trying to reconcile your view of what's happening in Israel with the position Netanyahu has taken in recent negotiations, where he said, I'm not going to reach an agreement with the Palestinians unless they agree I'm a Jewish state. It seems like he's seeking the blessing of Goyim, which is just the opposite of what you said is going away. So how do you...
Okay, first of all, I know. Once you say Israel, now there's a... Okay, now Israel's a problem, and I don't want to walk into a minefield, but I'll say one thing. I personally don't understand that part of the Netanyahu policy. Why do we need the Palestinians to recognize my Judaism? I don't understand that. But I want to say something else.
ask my students in the front, while Kerry was in Israel, Kerry came, I think, 11 times to Israel. He had like 140 advisors that puts him in. I asked my students in the front when they, who here is excited that maybe we'll have peace in the 9 months? No, no, it wasn't an issue. Kerry was coming to do it. It wasn't an issue. No one thought that the right didn't think, oh no, we might have an agreement. And the left wasn't like, this might be it. Israelis became very
realistic is probably the best.
Apathetic. What does jaded mean?
Apathetic.
Now, I think my good friend Yossi Kleiner Levy, I think, understood something deep happening in Israel. And I think there's a strong connection between the loss of interest in the Palestinian conflict
and the phenomenon I was describing now. And it's the following connection.
For many, many years, the conflict dominated the conversation and the imagination of Israelis. If you'd ask an Israeli if he's a right-winger, and he said yes, he doesn't. What he has in mind is not small government. He doesn't even know economic policies. It's about a big country. And if you ask left-wingers, if he's a left, it's not that he's about for a bigger government and more taxation and more involvement. He's for a smaller government. He's for, in fact, it was only focused, people's opinions were focused on the future of the conflict. And it hijacked the conversation. And if you ask an Israeli, only until a few years ago, what do you think about the Jewishness of the Jewish state? Well, I have some opinions, but we'll take care of that after we settle the conflict. And what do you, why don't we have a constitution? Well, it's important. We'll settle that after the conflict. And what about the great gaps between the rich and the poor? That's important. You know what we'll deal with that? After the conflict. The conflict held so many problems as hostages. The after the conflict narrative froze Israel. And you said to Israelis, so you know what they would say? So let's really solve the conflict so we can finally deal with other things. A very interesting thing happened in the summer of 2011. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis hit the roads, moved to tents, fighting for social justice. They didn't even know what they were fighting for. I'm serious. Some are fighting for cottage cheese prices. Some are fighting for what?
Cheaper housing.
Some are fighting for other stuff. It was chaotic. It was just, somebody nailed it saying, Ha'am rotze kol mine dvarim. The nation wants all sorts of things. But even though there wasn't a clear message, usually you have to have a clear message to have a lot of passion. Here there was no clear message and a lot of passion. Interesting. Now the interesting thing was, people hit, usually in the world, there's a symmetry between the amount of passion and the amount of violence. Here we had hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets, a lot of passion, hardly no violence, no violence whatsoever. By the way, that's also an Israeli startup. To create a passionate protest with no violence. According to the amount of violence, you'd assume there was no passion. But there was a lot of passion and no violence. And what were they fighting for? This never happened ever since 1967. That hundreds of thousands of Israelis go out to the streets, not because of Sabra and Shatila, not because of Oslo, not because of disengagement, not because of peace, not because of war, not because of the conflict, but because of something other than the conflict. And you know why this new passion burst out? Because the conflict stopped hijacking Israeli curiosity and Israeli passion. It stopped. It didn't do that anymore. Why? Not because we solved it, because the majority of Israelis don't think we can solve it. Yossi Kleiner Levy puts it this way: the first intifada shattered the dreams of the Israeli right. We realize we can't control the Shtachim because there's another nation there. And the second intifada shattered the dreams of the Israeli left. We realize we offered them, and they can. So for majority of Israelis, the conflict doesn't seem solvable. And because of that, other issues rose. I think what I'm speaking about now, about a new passion for Judaism, that unleashed itself not because we solved the conflict, but because most Israelis, not all of them by the way, but most Israelis that are not John Kerry, don't think we could solve the problem. Yes?
The interesting group you chose to mention, like the Durian and the Chazonish, or you know, what about other seminal figures in Israeli history, like the first Rav Kook or Yehuda Ashlag in terms of a new Israel.
Right. First of all, I think you're saying these are very, very important figures. They are not charismatic leaders of mainstream Israelism. Mm-hmm. These people, Ashlag is very esoteric. But the Rav Kook is considered the spiritual leader of a certain part of religious Zionism. Now, religious Zionism is a very important and interesting part of Israel. Very interesting part of Israel.
And growing.
And growing. And growing. It's a todah. It's a very interesting. What we find in religious Zionism is a lot of things. But let me offer one observation about what I think is happening in Israel sociologically. Religious Zionism also had its major visions, major ideas collapse. The Rav Kook's son, the Rav Tzvi Yehuda, created a theology, but according to the theology of the Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, its evacuations of Eretz Yisrael, of community in Israel, will never happen. So his disciples, before 2005, before this engagement from Gush Katif, you know what the disciples said? They didn't say, Asul Shteyat Kut. They didn't say, we shouldn't let this engagement happen. You know what they said?
It won't happen.
They said, it won't happen. Because according to the mystical analysis of history of the son of the Rav Kook, inspired by the Rav Kook, it can't happen. And guess what? It happened. And part of the charisma of that narrative was shattered in 2005. Now, there's still a lot of passion with Zionism, but there isn't the narrative. The messianic narrative is not working for many of them. Not only is religious Zionism suffering from a narrative that's less convincing, they're also suffering from a clash of leadership. Leadership. Because when so many important rabbis said there won't be this engagement, and it was, they lost part of their authority. And then in 2008 or 9, there was another moment in religious Zionism that really scarred the ability to create powerful leadership. Are you aware of the Moti Alon scandal?
Yes.
And the Moti Alon scandal is not only the most charismatic leader is involved in that, also a group of rabbis, Forum Takana, are the ones, and they started fighting in the newspapers with each other, and they all looked bad in the end of the day. And finally, 2012, we're just trying to say, it's about time that we overtake the rabbinate. And Soha, a great organization, is trying to take the rabbinate, meaning a friend of mine, David Stuff, was trying to take a rabbinate. And you know who attacked David Stuff? Badmouthed David Stuff. And in the end, neutralized his chances to be elected to the chief rabbi. You know who attacked him? Religious Zionists. So religious Zionism had its ideas collapsed in 2005, and in three different waves, the rabbinic authority is cracked. I think, by the way, this might be a good thing. Because rabbinic authority cracks, it might give room for more autonomy, for more creativity. But religious Zionism was something very, very interesting. I think it's in a crossroad. It's very, very interesting. On the one hand, it's growing. On the other hand, it lost its powerful narrative. It's lost rabbinic leaders. This is one of the reasons why Naftali Bennett became so popular. Because now we have no rabbinic leaders, but this tough, army, high-tech guy becomes a powerful political leader because he doesn't carry the religious charisma. It's something else. Religious Zionism is something, I spoke about secularism. Religious Zionism is going through something very, very interesting, and it might be very surprising also.
I know that we could go on probably for hours, but it's getting late and it's okay. Unfair to the speaker. I'd like to thank Dr. Goodman.
So let's take two more questions.
Go ahead.
I'm okay.
You're the boss.
Two more questions and then we'll do a finish. Okay. I think it's yeah. Fair. So who has the most burning questions? You choose them.
All right. Simcha. Better be burning.
Thank you for the extension. Maybe this is implicit in what you're saying, maybe it's not. But you spoke about the founding fathers of the state who are not familiar with the legacy. The Spartan, I'm not talking about the Dati, the non-Dati. So they're more traditionalist, they have a greater affinity to Judaism.
Yep.
I see that in Israel, and
yep.
I see it in Europe. And what happens to them in Israel is that if they, you know, in Israel they're small enough, it can either be that, be, you know, fully Orthodox or non-fully Orthodox. There's no room for something in the middle. And what I see, the Sephardim that I know in Israel, they would be yep. much more traditionalist.
Yep.
They just resent being coerced into doing one for another. So it is, you know, so I see that I went to a Ehud Banai concert in Tel Aviv in Sukkot. So I see that I see
yep.
the Sephardim, and it's,
yep.
Is that really part of the change where the Sephardim are no longer second class citizens, that they're having a greater influence on society?
Yeah. I think, well, first and foremost, the Israeli WASPs thought that they could control the identity of the Sephardi. If they were Orthodox, if it was somebody trying to make them Orthodox, and if they were secular, trying to make them very secular, and there was no respect for their very unique identity. Some people say, this is theory, that what I'm calling that this Jewish renewal they're having in Israel, secularism changing, it's in a dialogue with the Mizrahi model of Judaism. But then again, it's not exactly Mizrahi model Judaism. The Mizrahi model Judaism means that the community, the Mizrahi model, what he's mentioning, Mizrahi model means that the shul that I don't go to is Orthodox, and I'm not. I'll go there with my father, then I'll go do Kiddush at home, I'll go to the soccer game, I'll drive to the ocean. It's a pick and choose Judaism. But it's stripped from ideology. There's no ideology that explains why it's legitimate to pick and choose. It's just a very laid back, loose, easygoing. And one of the reasons why it has that is because I think a nice observation about the history of ideas is that secularism was a reaction to tradition. It was tradition, we wanted to release ourselves. And then also Reform Judaism is a reaction to tradition. And then, as a reaction to the dangers of reform and secularism, what was created as a reaction to both?
Conservatism.
Orthodoxy was, well, things are changing so quickly, so we should freeze everything. When you open, so we lose everything, we should close down. When you change, everything changes. So orthodoxy.
Conservatism
is something very, very. It was inside the reform movement, but it was much later. And the Hungarian form of orthodoxy was a reaction to reform and secularism. So you say, so what is orthodoxy? It's a reaction to tradition. The interesting thing about the Arab countries, that modernity didn't really come there. So there's no reaction to modernity. So it's not a reactionary Judaism. I would say today, in the Jewish world, it's even more complicated. If, let's say, secularism was a reaction to tradition, orthodoxy is a reaction to secularism, today most secular Jews are reacting to orthodoxy. Oh, we don't want that. And most Orthodox Jews you listen to, they're reacting to that reaction. So we have a lot of reactions. And there's an argument that these Mizrahi Jews are carrying with them not only active Jews, but something more authentic. But maybe 65 years in Israel kind of bad for many of them.
Manny.
Okay, great. I'm glad it's you.
I'm glad it's me too. I want to pay you a particular compliment in regard to the fact that you are able to convey to an American audience many things and distinctions about the differences between an Israeli outlook or the outlook of Israelis.
Yes.
And to make it understandable to us, because I'm sure if I have this experience that many other people in this room also.
Thank you for the compliment.
I've not understood the situation in the terms of the way Israelis think, even though we know there are major differences, but you're able to articulate it in a way that's very meaningful.
Thank you.
And that's a gift, but at the same time it carries with a responsibility that you have to be able to explain to Israelis what American Jews think, which is not as simple as it seems. And I give you a case in point, which is not so much a criticism, so much as an observation and awareness. You were just talking about secularism and reactions to it, and orthodoxy as a reaction, a back formation reaction to secularism. What you were referring to is not orthodoxy, as we see orthodoxy. You're referring to Haredism, which is not the same as orthodoxy. And a Haredi person here, many of our children are Haredim, many of our friends may be Haredi, but this audience is not Haredi. This audience, to the extent that those of us who are popular at the synagogue, for example, are Orthodox, not Haredi in any sense.
I'll tell you how I know you're not Haredi.
The Haredim in Israel have built a bubble around themselves. And
I'll tell you how I know you're not Haredi. Because sadly, I was never ever, not in Israel, North America, never invited to speak in the Haredi community. So if you invited me, I assumed that you're not.
I would.
Okay.
I'm a little bit nervous about thanking Dr. Goodman because you're not going to believe me.
So say it in Hebrew.
No. But I really think that I speak for the entire audience for this very powerful, thoughtful, informative, eye-opening presentation. It was really wonderful, and we appreciate it.
Thanks for that.